Good morning. It's The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about mental and physical health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Today in the program, we speak with Jennifer Farr Davis. She set a fastest known time, that's an FKT, record on thru-hiking the Appalachian Trail, and talks about various aspects of why we do what we do and why people have walked through the ages in pilgrimage or in search of something deeper they hope to find in themselves. She's written a book on these topics. It's The Pursuit of Endurance, Harnessing the Record-Breaking Power of Strength and Resilience.
And then we speak with Nick Infield. He's an Australian linguist. He'll join us to talk about how words like so are fundamental elements of how we communicate, even though we're taught to, well, get rid of those filler words. And we're taught that by our teachers and groups like Toastmasters. He explores this and many other topics related to conversation in his book, How We Talk, The Inner Workings of Conversation. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Wondering what's up for the weekend? Listen to The Morning Mix every Friday morning at 9 a.m.
We always have live music, interesting people, and weekend events.
That's The Morning Mix with JW and Christy, Fridays after NPR News. Brought to you by Campos Coffee, Squatters Roadhouse Grill, and Wasatch Brew Pub.
Crandall Capital, Utah Symphony, Utah Opera, and Peak Art and Frame.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, our guest Jennifer Farr Davis has hiked over 14,000 miles on six different continents, and she set a record for the fastest known time on the Appalachian Trail. She hiked it in 46 days, 11 hours and 21 minutes. This was a record for both women and men. She explores the why of tests of endurance, of the history of great walks and pilgrimages, and some of the other characters that have undertaken similar endeavors throughout the ages, and explores them both on the trail and off the trail to find out what makes these people tick. Through this exploration, she finds out what makes her tick. Jennifer Farr Davis, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me.
You know, maybe I'll start here with the why of it. And I suppose it's when people ask you why. I mean, if, you know, you had at one point the fastest known time record on the Appalachian Trail, 46 days. You know, when people ask you, why would you do it? Is it way too simple to just say, because I can, because I want to see how I can push my body, because I want to see how my mind can control my body to tell it what to do? How do you answer that question?
Well, I think you answered it pretty well. I think it is important to find the boundaries and possibilities of what we can do as humans. And that extends from everything to trying to find a cure for cancer, to a new invention, to try to develop a new math theory, or find out, you know, what are our physical limits and capabilities. And the people doing these multi-day trail records, it's very different than, you know, winning a marathon or running a four-minute mile. These people are saying, what can the body endure? What can it take? How long can it last when you're trying to cover 50 miles a day for weeks or months at a time? And so that in itself isn't important to most people in their everyday life, but the fact that our bodies can do that, I think sometimes it takes these extreme examples to inspire just moderate health and exercise, because it makes you recognize that, you know, our bodies are a gift. Yeah. And it's good to use those gifts, even if it's not in an extreme fashion.
Right. There's one line in here where you have just completed your record-breaking go at the Appalachian Trail, and you say that finally you could rest and you could put to rest the deeply held insecurities and curiosity surrounding your capabilities. So what were those insecurities about?
Well, for me, and not just through the record, not just going quickly, but you know, I've done the whole Appalachian Trail 3 times and hiked all over the U.S. and all over the world. And I think what draws me to the trail, there's so much, but one thing that draws me is, like, when I found it, the trail is what made me realize that I had spent my life living up to other people's expectations and not my own potential. Because until I started hiking and until I started backpacking, I was just doing what my parents, my community, my family, you know, my college professors, coaches, what they wanted me to do. And then I got on the trail and I thought, you know what? It might look different, but I can do more than what people think I can do. I can do different things than what people think I can do. And so that started the questioning, like, oh, well, if I can do more, like, what can I do? And it's taken several different, you know, paths, so to speak, because, you know, because of the trail, I started my own business. Because of the trail, I started writing books. But because of the trail, I wanted to find my physical limits, too. And that's really what led me to the record. And when I got to the end, I thought, you know, I found what my body can do. And that feels really, really good.
Jennifer, the trail itself is kind of fascinating. And for people who are listening, maybe you could share some of the details of that Appalachian Trail. And I know there are a lot of trails around the country and the world, and you've been on many of them, and you talk about them in the book. But how about the Appalachian Trail? Because so much of your experience kind of revolves around that. What states does it go through? How long is it? And let's go back like 50 years ago, and how long did it take people to hike the trail when they went out and attempted to do it in one contiguous adventure?
Sure. So the Appalachian Trail, I do love it. It is my home trail. It's very unique. You know, not as tall as the Wasatch Mountains. The trail's not as long as the Pacific Crest Trail out on the West Coast. But what makes the Appalachian Trail unique is the sense of history and community on the trail. Very popular. Over 3,000 people will try to hike the entire path all year. Now only about 25% make it, and it's definitely not who you think might make it. It's not the fastest or strongest or the guy who spent the most money at the gear shop. It's really, you know, a testament to mental fortitude, and that's what allows people to be successful. So there have been parents who have hiked it with their baby, their one-year-old baby. There have been five-year-olds who have hiked the trail. 80-year-olds have finished. legally blind individuals, a woman with a prosthetic leg. Like, you never know. You never know who you're going to meet out there. And for most hikers, if they want to do it all at once, it usually takes 4 to 6 months. So the first person to do the trail, I think it was in 1948, and he took about 4 months to do the whole trail. But at the time, and this I think is really important to point out, the trail was not built to be hiked all at once. So the first guy who did it, everyone called him the crazy one because no one thought that you should really like be able to hike the entire trail all at one time. And now people are doing it, you know, setting records, doing it in 46 days. And I think it's still important to remember that you can do that. You can have a challenge, but the trail's there for everyone at every phase of life. So if you want to day hike, go out with your kids, go for a weekend backpacking trip, test your limits on a week-long adventure, it's there for that and everything, you know, in between the 6 month journey and a day hike. So it's a very, very compelling, wise trail that just like draws people in and kind of holds them there.
And you said that the trail wasn't initially built to be done all in one attempt. So what has happened between 1948 when the crazy guy, the crazy one, did it in 4 months and today when you and others are doing it in 48 to 46 hours? Has there been a reconfiguration and improvement to the trail that allows for it to be done in one fell swoop?
No, the trail in most ways, it is better marked now than it was back then, but in many ways it's longer and also harder. In the beginning, it was connected still with several gravel or country roads. So it's not that the route has improved that's made it more manageable. It's just that people's mindsets have changed. And, you know, quite frankly, I think it was a little bit of an oversight for the original vision of the trail not to be something that could be hiked all at once. I'm glad that's not the primary intention. I don't think the main motivation for hiking the trail should be, you know, to do something that other people give recognition to. I think the trail is a very personal thing and should be able to meet people in different ways. But you know, we are part of this culture who has sort of lost the idea of like pilgrimage and transition. And when you look at history, when you look at other countries, when you look at other societies and cultures, the idea of long walks and transitions are a more valued part of different stories, other than our modern day America, where we jump to things very, very, very quickly, and even we travel very quickly. And so I think the idea that people want to walk this trail, even if they're doing it very quickly, which, you know, still you're going to maybe do 3, 4, 5 miles per hour on the trail, it's still a slower process than like our hectic, multitasking day-to-day life. So I think it's a very, it's filling a void in America where like we need to go outside, we need to use our bodies, we need to be in community that's not connected electronically, and the Appalachian Trail helps fill that void.
And you just mentioned something that I think is really fascinating. And initially, you know, when the crazy guy did it in 4 months, that was truly a pilgrimage. And you and others, and I don't even know how to phrase this because it sounds a little bit judgmental, but I'm sure you address this issue from time to time. What has happened in that mental state that has changed this pilgrimage from a wandering 4-month adventure to a 46-day all-out challenge? It sounds like it's been, you know, turned into a competitive event. A pilgrimage has been turned into something that's competitive, and is that good or bad?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think, you know, you're hitting on really one of the biggest misconceptions of these quote-unquote trail records or fastest known time. And, you know, first off, I want to point out that anytime you're doing a full completion of a 2,000-plus mile trail, it's not a walk in a park. It is inherently hard. You're going to have struggles. You're going to face difficulties. And then that's heightened when you're trying to go as efficiently or quickly as possible. And so, you know, what I found on my record attempt is that it was actually deeply spiritual, and it was transcendent. And it's funny because I compare it almost to like doing a fast, which, you know, on the trail when you're trying to set a record, you're probably eating 7,000 or 8,000 calories a day. So it's funny to say that, you know, it's like an extended period of not eating, but I think the revelations that come from it and the state of focus and also the state of just depletion. Mm. And that is a word that I will use for the record is you feel empty, but when you feel empty, you can take more in. So, you know, I think when people want to compare a traditional wandering 6 months through hike to a trail record, there's different pros and different cons, but at the end of the day, they're just different animals. And, you know, I've done them both. I loved them both. I don't think they're the same thing. And so it's good to look at them, you know, differently and expect that you're going to get different things out of them. I think when you go for the record, you're not as focused on pausing and taking in all of the scenery or having that picnic at the waterfall, but you're looking for something deep inside yourself. So maybe a more internal journey as opposed to, you know, an external wandering.
Mm. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jennifer Farr Davis. She's written a book called The Pursuit of Endurance, Harnessing the Record-Breaking Power of Strength and Resilience. She set the overall fastest known time record in 2011 by completing the Appalachian Trail in 46 days, 11 hours, and 21 minutes. That's an average of 47 miles per day. She was the first woman to set the overall record. Since then, her record has been broken by Scott Jurek, who beat her by about 3 hours in his own personal internal journey in 2015. So I love what you said about when you're completely depleted or empty, you can take more in. The crazy one should have a name. His name is Earl Schaefer. And it was in 1948, after World War II, and he was an operator, a radio operator in the war. He said he was going to walk off the war. And then you also start the book with this wonderful character, Warren Doyle, who in 1973 was, first of all, his sister passed away, and he was in this time of life where lots of people his age were going to psychedelic festivals and things like that. And he chose to find his something more by hiking the trail in 1973. Talk a little bit more about those kinds of characters.
Well, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to really write this book is because, first of all, everyone you meet on the trail is fascinating, and I love the depth of relationship and form of communication that comes with hiking, because it's not electronic, there's no barriers, you're just there, you're present, you're with someone. And there's so many people on the trail who I've met who, I mean, everyone has taught me something. Everyone can do something I can't do. But there's so many people I've met, I'm like, oh my gosh, their stories are so powerful. And the joy of this book, really this part that made it so fun to work on, is I got to handpick six of these people who have done things on trails that are just hard to believe. Like just these amazing, you know, efforts of endurance. But I know their off-trail story. And in my mind, their off-trail story is more interesting, more captivating, more compelling than the miles they've put down on a dirt path. And so for me to get to sit with these people, and every single person, just like Warren Doyle, every single person I ask, you know, did your hardest struggles, did your hardest challenges come on-trail or off-trail? They all said off-trail. And, you know, what I realized is that by doing the things that they did on these distance paths, what they were doing is they were like refining and relearning and honing their skills of resiliency and endurance. And they all learned ways to cope. They all learned ways to keep going. And they applied it not just to the trail, but, you know, when things happen, like when Warren did lose his sibling, and he had a father who was a veteran and had challenges. And, you know, another character, these characters, they struggled with, and they're not just characters, they are just real people. And they struggled with insecurity and depression and poverty and emotional abuse and divorce. And it's things that we all go through in the human experience. But they're revealing sort of their skill set of making the most of it. And I think that's what makes the book so, so cool and enjoyable, is these people in it are relatable, they're wonderful, and their stories are just transformative.
Mm. Your book is really an interesting survey about pilgrimages and walks that people have done throughout the ages. Actually, it was Warren Doyle who said to you before you started, are you ready to come away a different person? Are your friends and family, can they handle you coming away a different person? Because you will be. And you talked a little bit about it earlier. How did you really come away from it a different person?
Well, you know, at the end of the trail, and this isn't even, again, the record, but this just my first 5 month immersion in the woods, hiking 2,000 miles. I got to the end. My values were different. I valued simplicity. I realized I could be happy with just items in my pack. And when you recognize that, you don't invest as much money or time into things. And so I started to prioritize experiences and adventures and relationships. And that hugely changes your life when you recognize that at the age of 21. I also learned a lot about quality relationships, because the people on the trail were so different from me. So now my friends were all different ages, had different beliefs and backgrounds. And, you know, I had to accept and swallow and change the fact that the biggest obstacles to those relationships were not our differences, but my insecurities and my judgments and stereotypes. And the trail's so wonderful because you get out there and you get to know people for who they are instead of, you know, what they do, how they vote, you know, what team they cheer for. It's just a really deep, deep way to connect. And then I also, on the flip side, love solitude. And I didn't know that before the trail because I hadn't really gotten it in our everyday crazy, hectic life filled with people and noise and notification. But I love that piece on the trail. And then my sense of beauty changed. And this was so important for me as a woman, because on the trail, I didn't have media. I didn't have a mirror. I didn't have anything telling me what I should look like. And so I started to see myself through my interactions with other hikers. And even though I always thought that nature was pretty, I never saw myself as a true part of nature, a true part of all that beauty until I hiked the trail. So I got off, and I was like, I can do so much more than I once thought was possible. I'm willing to take risks now. I want to go new places. I want to meet new people. And it just changed the direction of my life.
So Jennifer, having that experience yourself and then writing this book, what's your hope and your hope that your audience will take away? Are they going to be able to, well, are you going to, inspire some people to go walk, go hike more and be engaged in nature more in whatever form they choose? But obviously, you know, the one that you're representing here that is represented in such an incredibly appealing way would be hiking. So I would think that there's a little bit of inspiring folks to do that. But there's also probably a larger body of people who will read your book and take something from it into their off-trail lives and create their own off-trail stories.
Yeah, I think that is the point of the book, is that these lessons, these tools or skills that the, you know, people in the book are conveying through their stories and examples, they're universal as far as their application. So I have the book with me. It just came out this week. I'll read you a quick paragraph to kind of summarize what you were asking. But it says, we all have our long trails, and most of them do not include much hiking or running. Our paths take the form of higher education, climbing out of debt, navigating a career, staying married, undergoing divorce, surviving tragedy, and coping with illness. And it behooves us not to come to quick conclusion about other people's paths, and instead approach each individual with encouragement and compassion. We might be on different trails, but we are all mid-journey.
Boy, I like that. What book is that from, may I ask? Is that yours?
Yeah,
okay.
That was mine.
Okay. I thought when you said, I have a book here, I thought maybe you were reading from some other book that you were sharing this insight from. Yeah, Thoreau.
No, on that Walden is from Pond. The Pursuit of Endurance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Well, that's wonderful. Yeah, it's really fabulous messages. When I was a kid, I have to say, I was a little bit ruined for hiking because as a family, we would go with the Green Mountain Hiking Club up to Vermont or somewhere and hike portions of the Appalachian Trail. I remembered, what are we going to do? We're going for the weekend to hike the Appalachian Trail. And I was like 6 or 7 years old, and my parents would send me down the trail and sing songs to keep me motivated and things. And it really turned me off from hiking for a long, long time. But I'm kind of coming around to it now. After 59 years, I'm coming back to hiking, and I'm really understanding what you see and what you experience when you go out for that pilgrimage and that wander is a lot different than what you experience when you're, trying to do it as quickly as possible, which I think I did when I was 7, and I have done for a lot of time up until now, too. But it's kind of nice to come back to hiking.
I agree. And, we have a 1- and 5-year-old, and everyone likes to ask, oh, do you want them to hike the Appalachian Trail? Are they going to be hikers? And I was like, my goal is that they don't hate hiking, because we do it a lot, and we want it to be child-friendly. And then I want them to find something they love, and it's probably not going to be hiking. Like, that's mama's thing, So I think you got to be really conscious when you are taking young kids out or taking beginners out or taking new people out, because you have to meet them on their terms on the trail, not yours. So that's a really important point.
And a mistake I've made with my own children. Gosh, they just don't like mountain biking the way I do. Amazing.
Yeah.
if only I could do it all over again and just take them out for little bits when they were young.
Yeah.
Georgia to Maine or Maine to Georgia, how do most thru hikers, and that was a new term for me, thru hikers meaning you're going to do the entirety of the trail in one season, what's the preferred route?
Still the most popular is Georgia to Maine, but that's changing a lot. More people are now going from Maine to Georgia. I've done it 3 times, and I went north once and south twice. But now a really popular approach is also to start somewhere in the middle and hike to an end point and then come back and finish, you know, the second portion or second half of the trail. And we call that, you know, like through hiker is a hiking word. We call that type of hike a flip-flop. Because you're not doing it continuously in one direction. And the flip-flop kind of extends your weather window and limits the crowds a little bit and disperses impact on the trail. So there's lots of good ways to do it, and there's not one right way or direction.
Mm. And what's next for you? Now you've written a book. What could possibly be next?
Yeah, you know, life is so full right now. This book was such a big project. I worked on it for 2.5 years while having young children. So now I'm just excited to, I feel like there was so much work and time and sacrifice that went into making this project. And I'm really just looking forward to like enjoying its like presence, like the fact that it's here and sharing the stories of these people who I love. Like, I sincerely love the people in this book. And, you know, I just want to, just like my kids, just kind of like nurture the life of this book, The Pursuit of Endurance, and help it to be what it needs to be, you know, apart from me now that it's sort of left the womb. So I'm going to stay focused on this book and keep hiking with my family and, trying to make a positive difference in people's life and for conservation and outdoor recreation.
Sounds great. Well, the book, The Pursuit of Endurance, Harnessing the Record-Breaking Power of Strength and Resilience. And there's a great, intense photo of our guest, Jennifer Farr Davis, on the front. I love that photo. There's just so many great things about it. So thank you, Jennifer, for joining us on The Mountain Life. Great to talk to you.
All right. Thanks, y'all. Have a great day.
Again, Jennifer Farr Davis, and her book is The Pursuit of Endurance, Harnessing the Record-Breaking Power of Strength and Resilience. It's The Mountain Life. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Whitney Ryan from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, These are all filler words that we inject into our conversation and we try to eradicate when we are, say, speaking on the radio or in public. But to a certain degree, these elements are fundamental to our dialogue with others. They're used to let our conversational partners know that we get it and we're listening. This is just one of the topics surrounding our communication and conversation habits that linguist Nick, or N.J. Enfield, discusses in his book, How We Talk, The Inner Workings of Conversation. We welcome Nick Enfield to The Mountain Life. Nice to have you.
Thanks very much for having me.
So the inner workings of conversation, as it turns out, that we need those filler words that we try to eradicate from our language, our spoken language, through things like Toastmasters and scolding from our parents. Things like and hum and so and the filler words.
That's right, we do. We are told not to use them, and it's a bit of a conundrum for us because, in fact, you know, if we could avoid using them, we would sound like we knew exactly what we wanted to say at every moment. We'd have perfect fluency. But in reality, you know, conversation is a very dynamic process. It's something where we have to think very fast on our feet, where we have to simultaneously speak while we're listening and listen while we're planning to speak. And so inevitably we're going to be crunching the various gears and cogs and so forth in our minds as we are in the middle of a conversation. And words like and so, these are what I call traffic signals in conversation, and they allow the other person to know something about what's going on in your head and something about the kind of time you might need or the sort of way in which you're framing the thing you want to say next. For example, what you want to say is something you're a little bit less sure about, or what you want to say sort of changes the topic slightly. We need these little traffic signals to help people know what's going on and where we're going in the conversation.
I think the traffic signals that we'd like to eradicate are the ones that don't really say anything. And I feel like while we do need filler words, we'd like to come up with more intelligent sounding ones. Is that correct? I mean, are there better traffic signals to use than others?
Well, that is an interesting question. You could try to replace the traffic signals that get sort of bad press, if you like. Those ones are words like and ah, so maybe we could just ask why they're regarded as bad or, you know, dispreferred. The reason, you know, I think is in a way they are a very clear signal that you're just not ready with what you want to say, and there can be a lot of reasons for that. But one of those reasons, you know, essentially reveals something about the fact that we're not ready, that our minds might not be working as quickly as we hope, that we're not well prepared to say what we want to say. And so in contexts like Toastmasters or when we're debating and that sort of thing, we really want to be able to show how ready we are, how good we are at performing. And the only real way to read the words like and ah, is that something's not going as we would wish. So people think of that. People immediately see that sort of downside to those signals because they're revealing a kind of a problem or a deficiency, and that's why we'd love to get rid of them. So if you simply learnt how to not say anything when you normally would feel yourself being about to say or ah, what would happen is that you would have these odd silences. That you would be, you know, delayed in your response because you're, for example, you're trying to find the word that you want or formulate your thoughts. And at that moment when we would normally say, to let the other person know, just to wait a moment while we get ourselves ready, if you just went silent there, this would be confusing to the other person and they'd be thinking, did they not hear what I just said? Why is this delay happening? And we can be very sensitive to those delays because of the speed at which conversation goes. So in the book, I talk about the speed of conversation, and that's why the traffic signals are so important. If you replaced and ah with something else, the question would be, of course, what you would replace it with. And because these words are so very frequent, we use them one in every 60 words we say will be either or ah. If you chose to replace them systematically with something else, it would have a very strange effect on your speech. You'd sound quite eccentric, I think. So, you know, it would not seem advisable.
I'm trying to remember what I read about what you just referenced, which is the speed of conversation, and that you talked in terms of milliseconds, and you were conveying the thought that there's a period of time where if enough time goes by, and maybe it was 600 milliseconds, it creates a social discomfort, and we don't know what to do with that. I thought it was the Japanese have very little break in their conversation, if I read it right. There was very quick, rapid. They were down to like 6 milliseconds or something before they responded, and the average is 250, but 600 creates social anxiety. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, globally, people are very sensitive to the timing of conversation. And if you go and make a recording of a casual conversation anywhere in the world, you'll find that it's a very fast back and forth. It doesn't matter whether the language is Danish or Japanese. People will be switching between speaker and listener at great speed, and it will sound like a very smooth transition from one person to the other. You know, I ask you a question, you give me an answer. And when you measure the time that elapses between the end of one person's turn in the conversation and the beginning of the other person's, if you measure and you put all the languages together, you see, as we've done in our work, that the average gap between the end of one person's turn and the beginning of the next person's is 200 milliseconds. So that's 1/5 of a second. And it's the same time it takes to do a normal eye blink. So we basically don't notice this this little bit of time passing. And as you mentioned, it's true that around that average of about 200 plus milliseconds, languages do vary. So Japanese tends to have a faster average, Danish tends to have a slower average, but the variance around that average is not a lot. So it's only a difference of, for example, if you compare English and Danish, the difference is only about 200 milliseconds on average. But that very small delay of 200 milliseconds can seem in the minds of an English speaker to be a very long delay, and they might come back from a holiday in Denmark and say, oh, these people, you know, take a long time to answer a question, but it's actually only a fraction of a second difference. When you delay a response in interaction, as you pointed out, the 600 millisecond point is a bit of a turning point in the course of interaction, where we start to see, if there's a silence of more than half a second, we start to see a sense of hesitation. We read into that delay something. We read into it a sense of, you know, reluctance to speak next or inability to respond, or maybe the person didn't even hear. So that's when a sort of a panic button starts to get hit after about 600 milliseconds. And we find that on average, there's once you get to a full second of silence, then that's really intolerable, and people will generally, for example, ask their question again or say something completely new. So there's something that I call the one-second window, and within that window, that's a one-second of silence that can occur in a free-flowing conversation. And within that window, there's this sort of delicate balance of little time slots within it. But what's really striking is the incredible sensitivity that we have to that passing of time in conversation.
Nick, we recently were part of a workshop that did Myers-Briggs personality type assessments, and one of them was comparing introverts and extroverts. And part of the discussion around introverts is they do have that longer gap before they respond, and it has the effect that you're describing. But I'm wondering if your research has turned up things that are personality traits versus societal and cultural traits, because you're talking in kind of the macro sense of cultural traits, but there also could be an individual personality trait that would affect that delay.
Yes, there certainly is. I mean, in our research, what we've done is really emphasized trying to look for human universals and really compare different cultures. And we've collected data from Africa and Aboriginal Australia and Europe and Asia. And we really wanted to look at this problem of cultural variation. But of course, as you say, within each community, you find that people can be sort of calibrated differently in a way in terms of how quickly or slowly they like to respond. And to really test that, you'd have to get a lot more data. You'd have to get many, many hours of recordings from different individuals and compare them. But we have thought a bit about this, and it helps to sort of understand, I think, the sense that different people in society or in a community kind of click with each other, but they might not click with other people. And one of the reasons, I think, you know, obviously one reason has to do with their beliefs and their values and their experiences. But I think another part of it is exactly this very sensitive timing that people have. And if you have a person who tends to come in very quickly when they're responding, they have a sort of a fast setting on their conversational turn-taking machine, that person's, you know, less likely to be a good conversational partner with someone who's calibrated a little bit more slowly, if you like. And so that, you know, there would be this kind of tendency to clash, that somebody will repeat their question before the other person, you know, has actually even had a chance to answer it. So I think that some of the kind of personality differences would really be manifest around what we might call calibration of the conversation machine. And whether, you know, those people who tend to wait a little bit more are introverts, you know, it's an interesting question. I guess there could be a lot of different reasons why people would tend to wait. I mean, one of the reasons is that if I think that, you know, everybody's like me and we tend to think that way, you know, then I figure that you're you know, I should wait, actually, because maybe you're going to continue saying what you want to say. So these types of clashes of settings between individual people also lead to the cross-cultural miscommunication that I alluded to earlier.
Mm. I've been thinking about, as you've been talking and I've been listening, about the quality of listening. And this conversational turn-taking machine or calibration, do you believe that it has anything to do with whether or not we're being a good listener? I've often been in conversations with people who tend to talk over you right when you're getting to the end of your utterance.
Oh, when does that ever happen?
Oh, you're so funny. And I wonder if they're literally not listening to what I'm saying and just waiting for the signal that I'm coming to the end of my sentence so that they can jump in.
Absolutely right. I mean, listening is incredibly important. And one of the things I emphasize in the book is that using language is not something that's just an individual skill. When we use language, it's not just a person producing some speech. You're essentially connecting yourself to another person who's playing the role of listener, and that's an active role. You know, we tend to think of listening as just passive, and we receive, you know, some information through language. But when you study what really happens in interaction, you put two people across the table from each other, and you get one, you know, to tell a story about something that happened to them, what you'll find is the other person, as they're listening to this story, will be nodding, and they'll be occasionally saying things like, uh-huh, mm-hmm, and giving indications that they're keeping up with what's being said. And those little bits of feedback, which are also a kind of traffic signal, are, again, very finely timed. So what you see is that the listener behavior it's very important in terms of the fluency of how a speaker, you know, is able to tell their story or able to communicate. I talk in the book about some experiments that have been done, one by Janet Bavelis and her colleagues in Canada, where they asked people to listen to stories being told by others. They just put two people around the table and said, okay, tell us a story about a near-death experience you had, you know, a near-miss sort of experience. And so one of the people would tell this story, and what they did is they asked the other person secretly to press a button under the desk when they heard a word beginning with the letter T. Mm-hmm. So what this did is it distracted the listener completely from paying attention to the content of the story. They just were listening for the spelling of the words and pressing this button under the desk sort of secretly. And they found that when you do that, when you distract a listener, they fail to produce these proper feedback signals. They don't say things like, uh-huh, mm-hmm, at the right moments. And when the punchline to the story comes, they fail to sort of give the proper appreciation of it. And this leads to the speaker becoming much less fluent, and they repeat themselves, and they have, you know, false starts and so forth. And it was a very good demonstration that listener behavior is crucial to speaker behavior. It's really a kind of a collaboration in conversation. It's a cooperative sort of form of joint action. This is one of the things that our research has really brought out.
Nick, it sounds like from what you're saying, you have to have effective conversation to have effective verbal communication. That back and forth, that listener affecting and impacting the ability of the speaker is fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a sort of a real change of our way of thinking about language. There's a lot of scientific work is done on language, and historically, most of it is really focused on what's going on in the individual's brain, what's going on in their sort of vocal anatomy. How are they producing their sounds? How are they constructing their sentences? And it's very much focused on the individual. But what we're finding in this sort of research and a lot of other new research that's coming out is that once we sort of view language as being an activity that involves at least two people working together, like two people, you know, playing tennis together, if you like, there's a sense in which one person's behavior has a feedback effect and a determining effect on the other person's behavior. So it's a shift from thinking of language as being something that's based in the individual to seeing it as an essentially social sort of process.
Now, a couple, 3 years ago, I heard an interview with someone, and it might have been you, but I don't know. I can't remember. And it was discussing language's role in the spread of ideas, and that you have to have a certain level of sophistication of language in order to convey complex and sophisticated ideas. And without that language to promote and foster, you don't see the spread of ideas. And it was sort of following the evolution of ideas and language together. And that reminds me of your exploration into Huh, which talks about convergent cultural evolution and the amazing things you found by examining that traffic signal, Huh?
Right. Yeah, that's research we did a few years ago where we discovered, to our surprise, that there was a word that seemed to have a universal function and a very similar sound across all of the human languages that we could get data for, and that was that situation when you haven't heard what the person just said or you didn't understand what the person just said and you say, huh? And the effect is that they repeat that. And we looked at very many different languages that are not related at all, you know, spoken in Africa and South America and North America and Europe and Asia. And it was surprising that we found this very common-sounding word with the same function, because the nature of language is that you'd never expect in two different languages the same word to have the same sound unless they're very sort of closely related. So when we observed that, we came up with the idea that this was the product of convergent evolution. And this is something that happens in a different species in the biological world, that the two different species are not closely related, but they might converge on a similar solution to a kind of environmental pressure. So, you know, the bodily shape of dolphins versus sharks is pretty similar. And obviously, you know, they're not very closely related, relatively speaking, but they have responded to the same environmental pressures. So what we did was to analyze the universality of Huh in terms of the pressures of the timing of conversation. And so essentially, going back to what we were talking about earlier with the timing of conversation, if you've just said something and I'm trying to process it, trying to understand it, the milliseconds are passing by, you know, 200, 300, 400, 500 milliseconds, I still haven't got sort of response to what you've said. I need to then quickly launch some sort of a signal that says, sorry, abort, I'm not able to respond here. And this Huh is a way of simply using the, you know, your mouth is in the most relaxed position. Your mouth is basically just open and you're not producing any particular sort of consonants or vowels. You just open the mouth and kind of breathe out, essentially. It's a very low cost, very efficient sort of signal that you have to produce in an urgent moment, as it were. And so we argued that this situation that I just described is going to happen in all languages. It's not related to the structure of the language or the words that have been set up. It's related to the urgency of the flow of interaction. And so that's a universal word that has not arisen from being sort of spread around the world. It's not like words like okay, you know, or Coke. These kinds of words, they're not universal, but they're very widespread in the world. It's a word that's basically developed and evolved in many different places around the world independently.
Mm. So we all sort of grunt. Grunting is universal because it often sounds like a grunt when you say, huh, huh, huh.
Right.
and so what you're saying is those, you mentioned the equivalent for saying what in many different languages, and it made me think about those two-syllable words that mean what, like in Italian come or Spanish como, or and that's not very efficient to use that word. So you're saying that it's more likely that those languages will revert to some form of saying huh.
That's right. I mean, it's basically the huh word is highly efficient, or we could say sort of low cost. Right.
Yeah.
So if I have to suddenly launch a signal to indicate to you that there's been a problem in understanding. It's the sort of least effortful thing that I can do. So on the one hand, there's a benefit there because it's low cost to me. On the other hand, you know, it's one of the downsides of that is it indicates potentially that I'm being lazy, and that's why, you know, words like heart are typically viewed as bad. You shouldn't say them. What should we say instead? Well, things like pardon me, excuse me, you know, expressions that are much more elaborate and they're sort of explicit about the imposition that you're putting on the person, asking them to repeat and that kind of thing. So languages will often have alternatives to heart. And there may be things like pardon me, excuse me, or there may be things like what or como, et cetera. And we find that universally, if a language has any word for this type of a signal to get others to repeat, it will be huh. And then it may add more ones to that. So when we've looked at other languages, we've found that typically they'll allow you to use a what type word, but many languages don't have that type of pardon me, excuse me, kind of polite word.
Isn't it fascinating that we could spend 20 minutes talking about the word huh? The word that we try to keep out of our language, or we think we ought to. We find out now that it's actually very, very important utterance.
And cost-effective.
Yes.
That's right, cost-effective. And, I mean, the functional load, it's very interesting in terms of people's opinions about language. Words like and ha are words that people have strong opinions about, but they don't. People don't tend to appreciate the sort of functional load, the great benefits that these words give us in everyday interaction, that they actually carry a great load and they give very helpful signals. You know, if you take heart, for example, it's a pretty important function that language gives you with that word, namely to get the other person to back up and repeat when you missed what they said. If you didn't have that, the conversation would potentially go completely off track. You'd have to eventually get the person to go way back to where they were a couple of minutes before. This type of a signal, it's so important because it allows us to immediately redress a little problem and just get back on track in the conversation.
Nick Infield is our guest, and his new book is called How We Talk, The Inner Workings of Conversation. Nick, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, that was Nick Infield, or NJ, as the cover of his book shows his name as, How We Talk, The Inner Workings of Conversation. Very interesting. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
Valley Behavioral Health is a local nonprofit and proud supporter of KPCW. We are your community behavioral health center and provide a broad range of services, including individual, family, couples, and group therapy for mental health and substance abuse. We serve all ages in all of Summit County. Please check out our website at valleycares.com or 649-8347 for more information.
For adventurers on a budget, the Utah Olympic Park offers a host of activities at no charge. Admission and parking are always free. Start with a tour of the Alf Engen Ski Museum and the Eccles 2002 Winter Games Museum. Best of all, come support athletes from all over the world who train at the park. Open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Details available at utaholympiclegacy.org.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life. A thank you to our underwriters.
Valley Behavioral Health, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Davidson Orthopedics, Park Meadows Country Club, Park City Mountain, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, and San Francisco Design.
You've been listening to KPCW Park City.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, FredMarshallPainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.